From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Whether you're trying to find Nemo or searching for the Holy Grail, if you're on the web, chances are you're using Google. The Internet's leading search engine is one of the hyper-envied tiny handful of companies whose name itself has become a verb. We're Googling by the billions, and it's changing human behavior. Tonight on Point, Google Mania, the business, the technology, and the sociology of search. But first, we begin in Washington. In a speech earlier today in Detroit, presidential candidate John Kerry proposed a pointed restructuring of the corporate tax code to push American companies to create more jobs in the United States. John Harwood has been covering the story for The Wall Street Journal. John Harwood, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
John, let's listen for just a moment to John Kerry in Detroit today talking about his plans for bringing jobs home.
We now have a tax code that tells you go overseas, and that makes no sense. And if I am president, it will end as soon as possible.
So, John Harwood, what is the Kerry plan to make that happen?
Tom, John Kerry has got a proposal that would do two things. One is to remove what he and his advisors say is an incentive in the U.S. tax code to promote the relocation of jobs to foreign countries. It's a provision that allows U.S. multinationals to defer U.S. taxes on money that's earned overseas. And he would use the money by taking away that tax break, which he says is about $12 billion, and use it to cut taxes across the board for companies operating within the U.S. So in one stroke, he's hoping to take advantage of the public attention and anxiety about the outsourcing issue and also portray himself as a pro-business, pro-growth Democrat.
So he'll make it less advantageous to do business overseas, more advantageous to do business at home, a kind of carrot and stick there. At the same time, he says he wants to add a lot of new jobs in the United States. What's he going to spend there to do that? And where's the money come from?
This is one part of his plan to stimulate jobs in the United States. He says he can create 10 million of them in his first term, which is slightly less than Bill Clinton created in his first term in office. In addition to this corporate tax reform, he would also provide a one-year, in effect, break for companies to repatriate money that they've been stashing overseas using this break and use the money from that one-time repatriation to finance a job tax credit that would be given to businesses in industries affected by outsourcing, give them a credit for putting new people on the payroll.
So he's saying something like $22 billion that would cover the payroll taxes for new employees, for manufacturers, for industries affected by outsourcing, for small businesses that employ fewer than 100 people. In other words, an incentive for hiring.
Right. Now, the question, of course, with all of this is how much will this actually affect job creation, or whether it is mostly symbolic. You talk to some business analysts, they're a bit skeptical. They say a lot of things go into businesses' hiring decisions and location decisions other than tax rates, but clearly this is one way that the U.S. government can change the balance of incentives in what Kerry says is going to bring some jobs back home.
So it wouldn't change a wage differential between here and China. It wouldn't change, I don't know, productivity differences if there were such things. But it would at least be, as you say, government taking a stand on this. And it seems to be one fairly well politically crafted. I mean, it's going to be hard to get people upset about taking away a tax break for doing business overseas. At the same time, he will get to claim that he's lowered corporate business taxes at home.
Well, that's exactly why this is an appealing proposal for them. It's difficult for the Bush campaign to attack this as a tax increase, even though it would raise taxes on some businesses, because he's lowering taxes on so many other people. Now, the Bush campaign does say that the provision taking away this deferral isn't going to raise as much money as John Kerry says it will raise, and so if they're correct about that, he wouldn't be able to finance as large a tax cut as he's talking about for businesses at home.
President Bush was also talking about the economy today in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Could President Bush just say, well, I'll do the same thing. I'll end that overseas tax break as well. Or is there some big vested interest in that tax break?
I don't think he can say that now because his campaign has already criticized this as just a reshuffling that wouldn't accomplish anything and that it would raise taxes on some people. What George Bush is going to try to do is highlight those aspects of the economy that are positive. Like today he was talking about home ownership, which is at pretty high levels historically speaking because interest rates are so low. He'll be talking about the stock market, which is back above 10,000. And he'll be talking about overall growth, which was 4% in the fourth quarter, which by most standards is a very robust rate of growth. The problem is in this particular economic recovery, when productivity is very high, it's somewhat disconnected with people's employment prospects. That's an opportunity for John Kerry to exploit.
John, what about big multinational American corporations? Are they going to push back against this Kerry plan? Do they count on those overseas tax breaks? Are those important to them or not?
It's not clear that they're all that important. The business reaction has been sort of lukewarm to this so far. Certainly businesses that operate here would like to see their overall tax rate reduced. One line of attack from the conservative end of the spectrum is that this is a bonanza for lawyers and lobbyists because it gets into questions of definition of what's a foreign company, what companies might be exempt from the removal of this tax break, because there are some that are would-be. John Kerry says that if you locate jobs overseas to sell to that country, you're exporting in effect, that this would not apply to you. But it's very difficult to get any sort of tax legislation through the Congress, and if the business community is not lined up behind this, it would be hard for John Kerry to accomplish, even if the Congress were interested. And remember, he will likely be facing a Republican Congress, even if he wins the election.
But at the political level, I guess it does show they're thinking creatively here, and this is going to one that might be hard to refuse. If it sounds like we're cutting corporate taxes at home, we're taking away this break abroad, that's going to have a fairly visceral, direct appeal, I would think.
They are thinking creatively, and you can really hear a little bit of echoes of George Bush's 2000 campaign in this. Remember, he said, I'm a different kind of conservative. I'm a compassionate conservative. Mm-hmm. Here you have John Kerry saying, well, when's the last time you heard a Democrat talking about cutting the corporate tax rate? I'm pro-growth. I'm pro-jobs.
Much more to come on the economic battlefield. John Harwood, thanks very much for being with us.
You bet.
John Harwood is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Washington. Finding what you want has become the core function of the World Wide Web. Whether it's a quote for your best man's speech or a rare Indonesian orchid, the way of the web is search. And Google is now all but synonymous with search. With its estimated $1 billion in annual revenues, investors are dying to get in on a Google IPO someday, soon, they hope. Search competitors like Microsoft, Yahoo, and others also want in on search. Google makes it look easy. But that simple homepage masks a complicated technology that is at the heart of a battle to decide whose approach to search will drive the web. Regardless of who wins, Googling or search is already being spliced deep into our language, our habits, the way we do the things we do. Is Google as much a part of your life as your toothbrush and your car keys? Are you chomping at the bit for the IPO? Is search, is Google now an extension of the human mind, of your mind, and where is it going next? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Palo Alto, California, is Gary Stein, senior analyst and head of the search practice, at Jupiter Research. Good evening and welcome, Gary Stein.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from Palo Alto is John Battelle, co-founder of Wired Magazine. His website, Search Blog, explores the culture and business of search. His forthcoming book is entitled The Search. Good evening and welcome, John Battelle.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to both of you for being with us. Google is just everywhere. It's in the air. You can't escape it. And everybody's talking about the IPO whenever it's coming. Gary Stein, I guess the first simple question, when is it coming?
Well, that's a I wish I knew, right? I mean, everyone asks me that question, and there's really no answer. We hear all sorts of conflicting things. There's some obscure finance law that someone has dug up that says, well, they need to start reporting because they've gotten to a certain level of employees and you know this
right.
and that. So that's a possibility. You know, we hear quotes from the founders and the people at the top, and they say it's not in our plans. We're not interested in it. So I think the expectation, though, in the community and around the world is that it's going to happen at some point this year. And, you know, there's not necessarily any reason they need to go public. You know, they don't need to make millionaires out of a whole bunch of people who are not connected with the company. But we do know that You mentioned a couple of competitors out there, Microsoft and Yahoo. And
some fairly deep pockets.
Deep pockets. They're going to need some money to compete against, against them. And, you know, you mentioned the word Google, a Google Times, right? I mean, that's this unknowably large number. And I don't know when they'll ever be seen as this valuable again. So there's definitely feels like it's coming soon, right? It's sell high.
This may be the very time. Gary, I'm told that you're at Google once a month or so getting filled in on the latest about what they're doing. Remind us of the backstory here. How did Google come to kind of own this category?
Well, they, you know, in a sense, they sort of fell into it, right? And they fell into it by doing simply the right thing. So I think maybe 5 or 6 years ago, two Stanford grad students began thinking about a way to organize information on the web and present it and create a search engine. And this is not a brand new idea. Yahoo had already been in existence, and there was a few others that were out there. They had a bit of a clever notion on how to rank things by relevance, which is by sort of letting the web tell us how relevant something is. By taking any given page and counting the number of times that it was linked to. And the more often you were linked to, you know, the more relevant. And every link is sort of a vote. So they built this interface and they launched it. And, you know, this happens all the time. A very clever technology is invented by some very smart people and it's put out there. And you know, 9 times out of 10, it falls totally flat. It never makes it out of the garage. Mm-hmm. Google totally took off. And it's a little bit hard to understand exactly why. I mean, my particular theory is two things. One is they made it totally simple. They focused entirely on search. And that was very present in the now famous all-white interface with just a box.
Yep, nothing but the box.
Nothing but the box. And the other thing is that around 97, 98, you would talk to your friends and your relatives and people would say, oh, I'm a beta tester for Google. It's like you're, you know, what? You know,
right. I remember
it didn't even sound like they were speaking English. And what they did is they seeded it out with a number of people. And I know it happened all around the world. In the Bay Area, there happened to be a concentration of it. But people began using it and they began talking about it. And they were in, right? They were on the inside because they were beta testers and word quickly spread. I mean, they have not spent a whole lot on marketing and advertising, certainly not to consumers. They advertise to other companies to get them to advertise on Google. But
the word of mouth is a kind of a global chorus at this point.
Yeah, exactly. And this is without the Giants playing in Google Stadium or anything like that, right? It's really been picked up on. And you know, I think there's some other things. It's got everything that a web brand should have. It's got some mystique behind it. It's got some playfulness. It's got technology that's been presented to you.
And now it's got a lot of revenue as well. John Battelle, jump in here with us. We're going to look at Google's business, at their technology, mm-hmm. and all of that tonight. But you're doing a whole book on search itself. Bring us some tall tent poles here about where this is headed, how search is changing the way we interact with the world, the way we interact with each other. What's the overall big scheme impact of search?
Well, one of the things is to step back and say, you know, Google and other engines, but Google in particular now, has become an interface for mankind or humankind's knowledge. You know, if mm-hmm. you sort of sit back and think about that for mm-hmm. a second, mm-hmm. that's a pretty tall responsibility. To fundamentally be the way people understand things. And also be something of an arbiter as to what exists and what doesn't.
It's just about as big as it gets.
It's about as big as it gets. And that idea is starting to filter through our culture. People are starting to realize the power of this search engine. And I would argue also Yahoo's search engine, which is starting to have similar power. Mm-hmm. And if you are in the first 10 results in a Google search, you exist. And if you're buried below the fold, as they say in the newspaper business, you don't exist as much. And if you're in the, you know, fourth, fifth, or what some call beyond the Google event horizon, which is sort of the 10th page,
right.
You really just don't exist anymore. And so if you happen to be related to a keyword search, but you aren't linked to it in the first few results of Google, your life gets measurably worse. And this happens in all sorts of ways. You know, people vanity Google and they'll put their name in. And if mm-hmm. they don't see themselves up in the first 10 results, or interestingly, if they see things they don't like about themselves in the first 10 results, it's a very anxious time because you realize that millions of people around the world are seeing what you're seeing and you don't have any control over that. And so you're anxious to figure out a way to get that control back.
So here's reality being defined by a technology, by a company, what exists and what doesn't, and maybe just how far the human mind extends. John Battelle, Gary Stein, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about Google mania and the technology, the business, the sociology of search. You can join the conversation tonight, is Google as much a part of your life now as your toothbrush or your car keys? Is it fair to say that Google is now the face of the Internet? Maybe its guts, too. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Google mania, about the business, the technology, the sociology of search. You can join the conversation tonight. Is it fair to say that Google is now the face of the Internet, or as our guest John Battelle would have it, the face of human knowledge itself? How do you use Google? How deeply do you trust it to find what's on your mind? Has it extended your mind? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by John Battelle, co-founder of Wired Magazine, author of the upcoming book, The Search. He's with us from Palo Alto. And also in Palo Alto, Gary Stein, senior analyst and head of the search practice at Jupiter Research. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. Gary Stein, give us a sense of how the technology behind Google and the competitors who are clustering madly now around the whole search arena, how that, where that technology stands today and where it's evolving.
Wow. So the technology is obviously the big secret, right? I mean, that is the secret ingredient in all of this stuff. And knowing precisely how it works, it's known kind of collectively as the algorithm, right? Mm-hmm. And so the algorithm is there's a program that's called the spider, and the spider goes and visits as many sites as it possibly can and grabs as many words from that site, and it's got a series of rules behind it, and then the algorithm tries to figure out how relevant it is, right? And the exact nature of that algorithm is pretty unknown, but obviously it's a source of a lot of focus. And I will say this about Google as a company in and of itself. It's very technology focused. Mm-hmm. Everyone looks to the algorithm, and there's some 1,600 or more people, I think, that are working at Google right now.
And algorithm sounds just like abstract math, but this is essentially kind of mathematical rules. If then, if then, if then, and pretty soon you've got a whole construct, a whole approach to this vast internet information.
Yeah, and imagine if you visit 10 sites that are all about Babe Ruth, right? And it gives a score, a ranking on each one of those, right? And that's, John was mentioning that if you're in the top 10, you exist, right? Mm-hmm. And if if there's obviously more than 10 sites about Babe Ruth, but if it decides, well, you're 11th as important, that's where you're going to end up.
But in terms, John Battelle, of where search is going, of the challenges, there must be all kinds. I mean, linguistic, geographic, even personality-based or kind of personalized mm-hmm. challenges. Where's it headed? What's not in the sci-fi future, but what's being worked on?
Well, I would actually, what are the grandest narratives of our culture anyways, is the narrative of the machine taking over mankind, mm-hmm. right? That mm-hmm. drives the Matrix series and the Terminator and all
this.
And so when you start to think about why that is and where one might see this start to emerge, really what has to happen is the computers have to pass the Turing test, which is a well-known test of artificial intelligence. Can a computer fool a human into believing that the human is in fact talking to another human through the computer as opposed to just a computer? Mm-hmm. And if there's one place where the Turing test might first be approachable, it's in search. And search is in fact one of the sort of most difficult computer science problems that exists, which is why the smartest CS graduates tend to gravitate towards the search problem. You are trying to figure out the intent of somebody's query from two words. Babe Ruth. Do they mean the candy bar, the slugger,
the biblical
someone's kid named Ruth?
Right.
And it gets incredibly complicated from there. And figuring out this problem is non-trivial, is very exciting for people in the computer science field, and it has so many intricate parts that need to fit together. And, of course, you're also changing the engines on a jet that's going a million miles an hour because the Internet itself is growing with such astounding speed. You've got, millions and billions of dimensions that you can take against any one query and try to figure out just the single point that best serves it. It's a very, very big problem, and solving that problem really requires that computer science get to the point of passing the Turing test, of becoming actually artificially intelligent. That's kind of exciting stuff.
Yeah, and Tom, I think I don't think you're going to see any of this real science fiction, at least like on the face of it, right? Because these, like, you know, the computer science graduates are going there. A lot of really smart thinking is going on there about trying to get to the bottom of that. And consumers aren't going to really see that. It's just going to be more efficient. And then there's this other whole aspect that an enormous amount of effort is being put on. I mean, we hear about spam all the time with email. Mm-hmm. There is such a thing as search spam, right? There are people who want to be in the top 10 results
and
for
Babe Ruth.
And
their way in. Yep.
Well, or they have no business being there. They just simply want the clicks, right? Mm-hmm. And there's ways to sort of try to trick the algorithm. Now, the computer science graduates, the technology department at Google and Yahoo and all the rest have to continue try to get better and better and better to keep those guys out. Because obviously, if you get a whole bunch of results that are just trying to, you know, sell you something that you weren't really interested in doing, it's going to make that experience less and less effective, efficient, pleasing for the consumer. So that's the other part of it, is there's this whole policing job that's going on the back end. That's where a lot of the effort is being put on, because that's keeping that that golden goose alive.
And yet, even it's easy to say or think it's not getting into science fiction, but if you just look at what people are doing already and the speed of access to very detailed and arcane information that is essentially now at everyone's fingertips, it already feels in some dimensions like sci-fi. The wonderful Joel Achenbach was writing in the Washington Post recently. He said, in the beginning, before Google, a darkness was upon the land. We stumbled around in libraries. We lifted from the World Book. We guessed. We conjectured, and then we gave up, consigning ourselves to ignorance. He writes, in the distant future, historians will have a common term for the period prior to the appearance of Google. They'll call it the Dark Ages.
And it's shocking that we were able to figure anything out, isn't it?
It's unbelievable. I mean, even a show like this, you know, the
right,
internet via Google produces information that drives a show practically every day. And that's just one tiny example. There are gazillions. John Battelle, it has changed the expectations of how quickly we can thrust our minds to the most distant corners of the world and of other people's lives.
I could make a reasonable argument, but I'm not sure time would allow that. Actually, Google thrusts us into a new Dark Ages, in that, in fact, what it makes apparent is what's on the surface and not what is, in fact, deep. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that when historians look back at this, they'll see a very brief Dark Ages we thrust ourselves into because we were sort of looking at the most shiny bits of the mm-hmm. web that happened to come up first, as opposed to the ones that were most relevant or most apropos to a particular query or research vein. One of the things that's well known among people who are sort of in the search community, but not necessarily well known to most of the people who use Google on a sort of cursory basis,
right,
is that 99% of the web isn't even available via Google. It's sort of stuck behind databases and dynamic content. So, you know, you, for example, have the entire Library of Congress, which isn't really searchable by Google, mm-hmm. although it will be in short order because they're working on that problem, in part with help from Yahoo. But the fact is that a lot of librarians would argue that we were actually much more enlightened when you had to have a human interface and some sort of focused, research-driven intent behind a
query. So we've got quick access now, but we're skating on the surface. You're saying, what's the path to all that deep content? A lot of that is proprietary. It's a lot of it is pre-90s and maybe even not digital. Is there a strategy out there to get to that on Google's part or anyone else's?
It's an absolute holy grail for almost every company in search. Google's mission is to organize the world's information and make it accessible. So, you know, they know that they've got a long way to go, which is one of the reasons they're confident they're going to be around for quite a while.
Right. And Google is doing it in sort of a mostly automated process, right, where it's going out and trying to discover everything that's out there.
Right.
So if something is not presenting itself as being very accessible because it's inside of a database, it's not going to find it. There are companies who are out there who are trying to create programs where it's more, let's make an agreement. Look, you pay me a certain amount of money, and I will come and I will look wherever it is that you want me to. Or better yet, you just tell me what's in there, right? Tell me what's in there on an ongoing basis. And this is something called paid inclusion. And that's an attempt to solve the problem. But again, you know, we're talking about 99% of the web, and this is going to get some part of it that's in there.
And you have an interesting, you have an interesting sort of virtuous cycle going on where people realize that it's important to be in this search engine world. And I think this realization is really just happening over the last couple of years. And they say, well, my God, you know, most of my stuff is not, in fact, being discovered by Google.
Ergo, does not exist.
ergo does not exist. So there is a strong attraction towards figuring out a way to get your stuff into the index, you know. And so that starts to, you know, to fold back on itself and create sort of a virtuous cycle of stuff getting included.
Sort of positive pull toward this universal mind maybe one day. John Battelle, Gary Stein, lots of callers want to join us. I want to begin to invite them in. John is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Hey, I just wanted to say, first off, I use Google. I teach.
Yeah.
I teach science, and so I use Google on a daily basis. It's really my search engine of choice.
Yeah.
It's wonderful, and what I found is that there's a real difference between if I'm looking for academic information,
okay.
I tend to get really good results.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm looking for, say, commercial information, if I look up, say, auto parts, what I get is the top 10, 15 links are all junk. There are companies that are, it's just like a listing with a couple ads on it.
Okay.
You know, and I just kind of wondered, you know, how did they plan on getting around that sort of thing? And even it seems like the paid ads, a lot of those come up as being, you know, just not real good sites.
John, let us pick that apart with our guests, and thank you very much for your call. Gary Stein, how does Google work in terms of what's shown where? John's saying that if he goes after a kind of academic target, he's likely to get closer to the information he wants. If it's anything that, as I hear him, has got a potential commercial angle, he may
right.
find first what he calls junk. What is Google's business model, and how does it relate to what we see or don't see in search?
Well, so the commercial searches are really interesting, and it's hard to describe this without a whiteboard because you have to start talking about this sort of class of businesses on the web called affiliates.
Mm-hmm.
And affiliates are companies that are essentially making money by passing links through. So if someone does a search on auto parts, he's able to put together a bunch of links like you just described. I mean, that's a classic example to, 27 different auto parts companies who are willing to pay this guy, whoever he is, a nickel if they give him a click.
And
right?
This guy's independent. He's not Google itself.
He's not Google. He's not anybody. But because he has a page that is chock full of information about auto parts and words that are saying auto parts here. And
he can package you high up in the list.
It ends up high on the list, right? So Google, this is when we talked about the algorithm and the policing that they have to do. They go after these guys. And I tell you, they do something. They change the algorithm. The algorithm is not carved in stone. They change it on an ongoing basis. They put revisions out. And when they change the algorithm, it's chaos, right? Well, it can be chaos, right? Because your expected position can get shot all the way down.
But
they did this in November.
This is because Google wants to keep it honest. They want it to actually be the sites with the most honest links.
Without a doubt, right? I mean, they really want it to be honest. And so academic, right, you would imagine that if someone is going to write something about how a carburetor works, it's not going to be a million links going a bunch of different places. It's going to be a scientific description of gas and oxygen and whatever, right? And so Google is able to recognize that this is a destination. This is an anchor point on the web, right? And that's why he's going to get a good information. If it's how to sell, where to buy the cheapest carburetor, and he's got links to 27 different places with, it's going to say, well, this is a bunch of links, and it's going to shove it way down. Google consistently tries to improve their algorithm to find these things and to rank them below what we can call anchor pages on the web.
John, describe for us, how does Google make money?
There's a model that was established in about 1997, 98 by a company called GoTo, where they basically created a search engine and allowed anybody who bid the most to be top in the results.
This is the anti-Google model, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, it was pretty much rolled out as that, yes. And it was almost universally ridiculed. Well, that company grew to $1 billion in revenues, changed its name to Overture, and was acquired for $1.2 billion by Yahoo last year. And it's that model, the model of paid advertisements that are
pay for placement, pay for priority,
right, that are contextually placed against the keyword on the right hand side in Google and in various positions on other search engines like Microsoft, MSN, and Yahoo.
So you're saying in Google they don't put it right in the list; it's off to the side as ads. In some others, are you saying in Yahoo now the first results you get may have paid to be first?
No. Yahoo makes a point that they do distinguish in their advertising. However, there is a separate revenue line that Yahoo has, which Gary mentioned, which is called paid inclusion. Now, paid inclusion, they claim, does not in any way affect your ranking, but will make sure that your stuff comes up when people search for it. But the paid advertising side of it is really something of a revolution in marketing, in that it is actually advertising that is directly related to a singular intent of a singular consumer, as opposed to the mass advertising we're all familiar with, where you may be sitting down to watch a television program and
sure.
you're a 40-year-old male and they're up pops an ad for, you know,
Depends.
For Depends. Now, there may be a chance you're in that demographic, but more likely than not, if you're fortunate, you aren't in that demographic.
This is far from the kind of ideal of the universal mind, the direct access to all knowledge. What are the arguments for and against here? What's going to prevail, Gary Stein? Is it going to be the pay for placement or the sort of more honest, less biased, maybe more true search for the best info?
Well, okay, so I mean, you're the true is
that's a value judgment.
It is, right? Paid inclusion, and particularly the program that John was mentioning is fairly controversial right now, and it's something that was released within the last month, and it's kind of winding its way through whether or not it's true or not, you know, or fair. Well, the ads that show up as search ads, right, which are on the right hand side, are extraordinarily effective. Way more effective than the commercial for Depends that shows up mm-hmm. on the television screen. Mm-hmm. And so advertisers flat out love them. And they're very clearly marked. We've done some research that show that consumers really do get it. They understand that these are advertisements and they are shown totally relevantly. And they're very often consumed as part of the content. Now, when the site shows up in that listing, there's definitely some people who kind of look at that a bit askew and they say, well, you know, that's really an ad. You're paying for that. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is... And we're leaving off a critical point, which I'll get to in a second, right?
Okay.
Is that because it's not necessarily easy to get high relevance rankings, right? Mm-hmm. So companies are very frequently hiring other agencies. They're spending a lot of work internally. They're spending a lot of money on making sure that their site ends up high in the rankings.
Okay, sure.
So what we're seeing, especially for a commercial search, even in the natural listings, someone has put in a lot of effort, meaning they put in a lot of money for that.
So it's a kind of manipulation, a kind of effort, whether Google's part of it or not, to be high up in the ranking.
And you know, the ultimate thing about this, right, is that if you are not relevant, Google and Yahoo and many other search engines will not show you, right? I mean, the technology is pure. The programmers are looking to solve a particular problem, which is organization of the web. You cannot buy your way into relevance, right? You can buy services that will make sure that you show up as being relevant, but if you're not actually relevant, it's not going to work.
John Patel, we've just got a minute before the break, but in your conception of Google or search as the gateway to human knowledge, what's the impact of commerce, of the economic interest here? What does it mean about how we're going to perceive human knowledge in the future?
Well, I think it's the way that we pay the bills for making this knowledge available. And I think it's a great thing. I mean, one of the things that I think Google's finally getting to is a realization that, in fact, it is a media company.
But there may be some important knowledge that doesn't have a dollars and cents value currently attached to it.
Well, that's true. And in fact, when you get to that point, you get to, like the program that Yahoo recently rolled out, is in fact has two pieces to it. And one of them includes bringing knowledge into the index, which has no commercial value, but has a lot of value to the users of that service. Now, if the users of the service find the service valuable, the service will figure out a way to take that value and turn it into money.
We've got much more to look at here. We're with John Patel and Gary Stein. We're talking about Google mania tonight. You can join the conversation. Do you expect to find the world fully reflected in Google? Is it really there? Do you Google first dates for a background check? Do you Google yourself? Do you like what you see? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Google mania, the business, the technology, the sociology of internet search. You can join the conversation tonight. Is Google now an extension of the human mind, of your mind? Is there a downside to Google? And where will Google, where will web search ultimately go? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by John Patel, co-founder of Wired Magazine and author of the upcoming book, The Search. His website, Search Blog, explores the culture and business of search every day. Also with us tonight from Palo Alto, California, Gary Stein, senior analyst and head of the search practice at Jupiter Research. Terry is calling from Boston. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question that it's still a little fuzzy in my own mind, but I'm going to try and pose it and see if it makes any sense. We've got a lexicon of information that's established, and that's basically what gets spidered and such.
Right.
We keep talking about sort of the marketing aspects and ranking and companies paying to be ranked higher and so forth and so on in the
mm-hmm.
advertising.
Mm-hmm.
My question is basically, to what extent is what Google does, I guess the algorithm is what I'm more interested in, is it actually influenced by the queries that are run, by the searching that's done? So the result set is now not just basically a matter of the marketing dollars put into it, but the actual queries themselves. And to what extent does this enable you to sort of push back the frontiers of knowledge as it pertains to Google itself?
So you're looking for a kind of fraction, a kind of ratio between marketing input and straight search. Gary Stein, how would you respond to that?
Well, Google, again, we don't know precisely how it works, but I do know that Google learns from everything. You know, it attempts to seek all inputs to try to make itself smarter. So does it add those queries and help it understand? I would, if I had to guess, I'd say yes. I know one thing it does is they do things they call negative clustering. So on the chance, when it doesn't quite get it right, when a search is put out there and it gets it wrong and it's got some way of understanding that,
mm-hmm.
they help correct the algorithm. They help drive it towards a more correct answer. So I know that is one way that they use the queries in and of themselves.
And John, this is a bit of an extension of what we were talking about before the break, but in a way, mm-hmm. Terry's asking, what's the distinction between the yellow pages, kind of paid face, and the more expansive vision that you outlined yourself at the top of our conversation, this kind of gateway to the human mind?
Well, I mean, the Yellow Pages model, so to speak, is just how the whole thing gets paid for. They have a service.
But it's not really just you can't really say just, can you? If we're talking here long term about this being a sort of shared electronic annex to of human knowledge, the human mind, if there's a financial structure around it that shapes what we can get access to and how we get access to it, that mind may not be anything like a reflection of something more or less commercial.
There is no question, and as there is in all of life, and particularly in the United States, which is a pretty business-driven culture,
yep.
a strong interplay between marketing, commercial culture, and knowledge. Google would argue, and I think is being quite honest in saying that, in fact, the AdWords, which is the name of their commercial paid search program, is in no way affects how their organic results are served.
Right.
Yahoo would argue, in fact, the same thing. But the fact is there is always an interplay, whether it's intended or not. What we discussed before as spam is one of those interplays, mm-hmm. because people are trying to game the natural results. But the queries themselves, I think, are part of a sort of three-part series of what happens in search. One is the query, the other is the path, and the third is the results that are shown.
Mm-hmm.
And taken together, if you want to really sort of get a little meta about human knowledge, that set of data, what people are asking for, where they are going, and what results they are given as a part of that whole process, is an extraordinary database of what I call a database of intention. Knowing what people want. Google is in the business of knowing or trying to know what people want.
Mm-hmm.
And when you know what people want, you become an incredibly powerful arbiter of culture, because you can then tell other people what other people want, and you can mediate that, which is exactly what they do with the AdWords program. And one would imagine that perhaps governments might be interested in knowing what people want, for example.
Presumably, I understand. Tell me if I'm right here, that Google has giant data banks with every search that every individual has ever done still recorded in them. Is that urban legend or true?
Well, it's a little bit of both. In the beginning, in the first few years of search, storage was simply too expensive
mm-hmm.
to make that possible. But the cost of storage has gone down so precipitously that, in fact, most search companies do store most of the data that they receive, if only to be able to do their own log analysis so they can get better and smarter, as Gary was pointing out. I think in the future we're going to see the cost of storage so low that it actually would be criminal not to save this, because imagine you're an archaeologist 1,000 years from now. Wouldn't you want that artifact to understand what human culture was all about?
I'm sure you would, but given the way librarians have been concerned about the government tracking the books we check out, which now seems kind of a semi-antique behavior. The idea of some authorities tracking every Google search you'd ever done is chilling or exciting, however you want to look at it. Yeah, here's a question. Sergey Brin, if I've got the pronunciation right, has said, was quoted recently, this is from Newsweek, he said, certainly, if you had all the world's information directly attached to your brain or an artificial brain that was smarter than your brain, you'd be better off. He says, between that day and today, there's plenty of space to cover. But that seems to describe the kind of goal that one way or another all the search companies are leaning toward. Is that right, Gary?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. You know, it's the promise of knowledge. It's the promise of deep knowledge. And that's what's so attractive. That's what's so attractive about the Internet, period, right, is this is this exponential expansion of your powers, right? And Google makes it easy, right? If that's the promise, if the Internet had a brand, right, it would be exponential empowerment, right, or exponential access to whatever it is that you want at any time. And then the thing is, how do you do it? Well, you know, Google's got it. That's all they do, right? It's just a box, right? And you click the and if you're lazy, you click that I'm feeling lucky button, and there's your answer. There's whatever it is that you want. You know, all the things that you listed. The capital of wherever,
Kazakhstan,
you know,
and off we
Kazakhstan.
Go. John Battelle, then take us out a few years here. Wireless and mobile are getting more powerful. The web is getting more directed that way. Personalization of search is clearly growing. Are we going to be walking around with kind of I don't know, buttressed intelligence everywhere we go?
Without question. I think that, you know, people can't really imagine the way that we're going to use this infrastructure because the devices through which we use them have yet to be invented. But the fact is that if it can be done, it will. And you know, that's been proven over and over in the history of technology. And when you've got a massive infrastructure of knowledge at your fingertips, we'll figure out ways to run that through our glasses or you know, we've already figured out a way to run it through our PDAs and our you know, our phones and so on. We will run that through all sorts of other – when it becomes cheap for massively powerful applications to be distributed, all sorts of interesting things occur with technology. And so I think we will see that. It just sounds weird right now. It sounds science fiction. But I think it's going to be quite normal in the future.
Weird, but not as weird as it did before Google. And Gary, what about Microsoft sitting here, not on the sidelines anymore, saying we made a mistake not getting in here earlier? Do they have a strategy that's understood for combating the primacy of Google? Do they have an end run to make here?
Yeah, I mean, we assume so, right? Steve Ballmer yesterday at his at a meeting of advertisers said the thing that I regret the most was not doing this ourselves, to partner with other companies to provide search for it. So you got to think of someone like Steve Ballmer with the checkbook he's got and the legions of programmers that he's got. He's going to apply a lot of force towards this. I mean, the expectation is that MSN, you know, Microsoft is going to have something out there by the end of this year.
But is there a clear flanking opening here for Microsoft, John or Gary? Is there a vulnerability in Google that they can go after?
One of the things that Microsoft has is the ability to tie it into their desktop applications, right? I mean, if you ever typed a letter in Microsoft in Word, right, and you say, "Dear John, right? Mm-hmm. The little paperclip says you seem to be writing a letter. Can I help you?"
Yep.
Imagine if you type in archaeology, right, and the paperclip says, "Hey, you seem to be doing a report for high school, and can I help you?" And this taps all into all these different advertisers and search.
So pretty soon, Microsoft Word is talking with the whole internet via.
Well, you know, I mean, you can really see these things start to happen, and this is what's you know, in their next release of the interface, Longhorn, that's what we expect to see happening. That is a big scary thing, I think, for anyone who's out there. When Microsoft gets in, it's not going to be a binary war, right? It's going to be three big players and maybe more, and it's going to fundamentally change the way people are going to make decisions about what they're using and partnerships.
John Battelle, we just got a few seconds. Where are you putting your money? Google, Microsoft, Yahoo?
Internet media broadly. I wouldn't count.
All of the above.
I think that one of the lessons of this has been that, in fact, a lot of the hand-waving of the late 1990s was, in fact, accurate. It just came a bit early.
Yeah, and now comes the fun part. John Battelle, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
John Battelle, co-founder of Wired Magazine. His forthcoming book is The Search, and Gary Stein at Jupiter Research, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, you're very welcome.
Gary Stein, also with us from Palo Alto tonight, senior analyst and head of the search practice at Jupiter Research. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, cookies and calories for $4 a box. This is On Point. Americans are fatter than ever, and fingers are being pointed in many directions as the nation comes to grip with its increased girth. Earlier this month, the House passed legislation protecting restaurants from obesity-related lawsuits. According to Republican Representative James Sensenbrenner, the bill says, look in the mirror because you're the one to blame. Oregon resident Susan Nielsen says there's another party that deserves some blame for America's obesity epidemic. As she gobbles down her Thin Mints and Caramel Delights, she points her finger at the Girl Scouts and their beloved calorie-laden cookies.
I'm waiting for the federal campaign that finally blames the Girl Scouts for the national obesity epidemic. You've heard all the usual reasons why 30% of Americans are now large enough to enjoy their own gravitational force fields. We eat too much, we work too much, we drive too much, and we're preyed on by complex societal forces involving the corn syrup industry. But maybe it's more simple than that. Maybe it's just the Girl Scouts. More specifically, maybe it's coworkers who pass around those plates of Thin Mints and Samoas, forcing us to associate cookie eating with all that is good and right in America. I'm eating some right now and can't stop. I may be morbidly obese by the end of this essay, but it's no use. I am addicted. Everyone in the office is addicted because of secondhand cookie eating. You spy one coworker grabbing a handful from the communal paper plate and start to feel worried and threatened. So you swipe some in self-defense. And then the cookies are gone. Blood sugar plummets and everyone rampages to the vending machine, the jar of Hershey's Kisses, a Starbucks, or any place that can fill the void. It takes all summer to recover from cookie season. Then it's Halloween and we fall again. I blame the Girl Scouts. I used to be one, so I know the kind of charm and serpentine cunning required to sell 100 boxes and earn a patch. You appeal to people's hearts. You appeal to their sympathies. Dragging around a little red wagon in the rain and limping seems to help, too. Only 2 more boxes and I get a patch, you say, at the entrance of the grocery store, a small, bedraggled urchin with haunting, hopeful eyes. And the customers, who don't realize they're falling under the fattening spell of the green menace, get out their wallets and start eating, eating, eating to support the future of America's children. Those scouts have us where they want us. They know we can't get any work done when the Samoas are in the break room calling to us like little coconut-covered sirens. Think it's coincidence that a box of cookies costs about the same as a pack of cigarettes? The scouts know Americans get addicted to things $3 or $4 at a time. So I'm waiting for the feds to go after the scouts. I'm waiting for the ads that show grainy footage of Girl Scouts pouncing on unsuspecting shoppers. The investigations that uncover Girl Scouts systematically preying on people who look like softies or people who look like they've never said no to a cookie. I'm waiting for the sting operation that sweeps up all the adults who've become dealers for their children and grandchildren. But Girl Scouts are short enough to walk right under the radar. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention never mentions them. The experts never blame them. I mean, what kind of jerk blames little girls? Anyway, no need to pick on the Scouts. They're a wonderful organization, and they're responsible for no more than 5% of my total body weight. But I do wish the fight against obesity could be won by, say, simply banning the sale of Girl Scout cookies in the United States, or at least limiting cookie sales to 1 box per Scout per year. Instead, we get to experience the quirky new federal ad campaign that intends to trim America's fat. The ads will tell us to stop the presses, eat less, and exercise more. That's easier said than done. No one knows how to end Americans' glorious love affair with hamburgers, hot dogs, apple pies, and all-you-can-eat lunch buffets. No one has discovered how to break the association between food and all that is good and right with this country. And everyone is helpless when the green menace, armed with those cursed little cookies, comes to town.
Susan Nielsen is a columnist with the Oregonian newspaper. She lives in Portland, Oregon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.